It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Roughly one-fifth of U.S. virus deaths are linked to nursing facilities. So this hour, we're going to look into what lockdowns in these facilities mean for the care of their residents and also the families who are often prevented from visiting due to these lockdowns. We'll hear from a physician a little bit later in the program, also a certified nursing assistant. These certified nursing assistants are very frequent in delivering care at the nursing facilities. We want to hear from you this hour as well. Have you tried to visit, or are you prevented from visiting a loved one in a nursing home or a nursing facility due to the COVID virus? Tell us about your experience this hour. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's start with my guest, Sherry Mortiz, is with us. She's a retired school teacher, lives in the Des Moines area. Sherry, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
I see in your background you're an activist in several grassroots organizations there in the Des Moines area, but we're here, having you here today to talk about your mother. Your mother died, I understand, at an area nursing home earlier this month on April 4th at the age of 97. Our condolences to the loss of your mother.
Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Before we get to the COVID episode, let's talk a little bit about your mother's background at this facility. How long had she been in their care prior to this sudden ramp up into what our society has become under the COVID virus?
She was there for 12 years. So she began in the assisted living unit and then transferred to downstairs, which she qualified for Medicaid, and she also required more nursing care. So that's where she spent the majority of her time.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about the care there over this 12-year period before the COVID crisis? Were you and your rest of your family satisfied? Or
there was a change. We saw really a change just in the kinds of challenges that they were facing. At the beginning, it seemed like the facility was more affiliated with a church and there was a lot more volunteerism.
Mm-hmm.
And then we began to see kind of a change away from that. They tried to institute programming so that they would have activities, but there just seemed to be less and less of it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly less activities that were really designed for, you know, varying levels of functioning. We saw a change, and then it got to be where we really didn't see the managers. When my mother first moved into this facility, the managers were out. They made a real effort to get to know the families. Mm-hmm. You know, if we had concerns, we could talk directly to management. That shifted dramatically,
Did you get the sense that this was due to stretched resources, the people there, the funding for it, or couldn't you tell?
It seemed to be just really a different model of management. Mm-hmm. Because it was just difficult to communicate with management, which was a real concern for us. And so we felt like there was just kind of a shift in sort of the management model that, you know, the office and the business office was strictly about billing and that sort of thing. And, you know, you could go to the social worker, to the activities director, but when there were some real irregularities sometimes in the billing process, it was those kinds of things that were very much different. And just the fact that we didn't even know for sure who the manager was. We didn't seem to be able to have that kind of relationship where we would even recognize who they were if they even walked by us.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt different.
I understand that during the course of the care of your mother, you also lent care to your mother, feeding your mother, for instance, prior
Yes.
to the COVID crisis. So how often was that?
Well, what we ended up doing was she began to get a little bit more persnickety about the kinds of foods that she would eat. And then that kind of got to the point where she really didn't like to eat solid food as much. And so she was drinking nutrition drinks. And so we realized kind of what her goal weight had to be, and so we went every single night, either I or somebody in my family. And then 4 years ago, we brought in a friend, because we knew that the staff was stretched. Understaffing was a constant problem over the last, you know, several years, really. The turnover seemed to be really just a difficult issue for them to handle and for us to get to know them again and then inform them kind of about what my mother's needs were, because they're all different, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So take us now to the just a few weeks ago. March, I expect, is when this particular facility was locked down.
Yes.
What was your experience then? When did that happen, and how did that experience of visiting your mother change?
The nursing home went on lockdown right around March 14th. And so when they mandated that, it also meant that not only were we not allowed to go in, we would have to visit from outside through the window, but the residents were isolated in their own rooms, so they could no longer go to the dining room to eat or go to social events or music concerts. And so that level of isolation was also just really devastating. My mother was hard of hearing, so it was difficult for us to communicate with her through the window. And so, you know, there was just sort of this complete feeling, I think, of isolation that we felt, and so did she.
Yeah, so I'm picturing you're outside, you're physically outside,
yes.
Sometimes maybe trying to attract her attention, sometimes pounding on the window to have any contact with your mother, 97
well,
years old.
We were able to get, we knew what time they would typically come and get her and get her ready to go to the dining room. So we asked if they would simply, you know, through that series of tasks, if they would also bring her to the window. So we tried to see her every day at that time. So they were very good about that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was hard to tell what was going on. She was very, a little tiny petite thing. She weighed 94 pounds. And so she was always cold. So she wore winter clothing, and she always had this shawl around her. So what we were not able to really see was how fast she was losing weight. We had said to them, this lockdown is not going to be a good situation if somebody can't spend time prompting her to drink her nutritional drinks. It wasn't that she wouldn't drink them. She loved them because they were chocolate, one of them. But it was because she would have to be prompted, because she would forget. She would just lose her concentration.
Right.
That's
she was suffering from Alzheimer's as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Take us up to the day that she passed, April 4th, the circumstances surrounding that day.
Okay. Well, it actually started 3 days before, because we began to question her health, if she wasn't going downhill. She seemed less, she loved music, she loved to dance in her wheelchair, and she seemed lethargic. And then I'm going to say it was April 1st, we went to visit, and she was just slumped over in her chair. And we said, wait a minute, you know, this isn't right. And so we called and talked to the nurse, and we said, we want hospice in there. You know, this isn't good. You know, this is, something's really going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when I was really informed. You know, I asked about her weight, and she had gone from 94 pounds to 82 pounds in mm-hmm. 3 weeks.
Mm. Oh, that's a lot.
And
of
we
weight.
And mm-hmm. her geriatric specialist, before she went into Ramsey, she was seeing a geriatric specialist, and he told us, you know, this equilibrium that they have to have, this weight that they have to be able to maintain, is critical. And so we knew that losing weight for her would be critical, and it really was.
Yeah. And were you able, on the day that she passed, were you and other family members able to be with her?
Yes. So we notified hospice about April 1st, because we knew that is the only way we would be able to get in to really see what was going on. And she was incredibly weak, and we just knew that she would not, when we realized how much weight she had lost, then we realized that we probably weren't going to win this battle, and we didn't.
Okay. You were able to be with her when she passed, the moment
yes.
she passed. I mean,
yes.
because that is the big, The big fear with this coronavirus crisis is that people are dying in isolation. And
She had never been diagnosed with that. So we were there with her for the 3 days before she died, before she passed.
Tell us, looking back, Sherry, what could have been made better in your eyes? We're all under extreme circumstances. The people who work in the nursing facilities certainly are. What could have been made better in your eyes, looking back, considering the need to keep the COVID virus from spreading? Because these are real hot spots.
Yeah.
As I mentioned at the outset, drastic action has been taken and needs to be taken. I assume you agree.
Yeah, absolutely. The first day that I went into the facility, they took my temperature. I was directed to the receptionist's desk right inside the door. But no one was wearing a mask. I brought a mask. And so I spent, you know, that afternoon and evening with her. And when I actually was on my way to her room, two CNAs came up to me. And they wanted
certified
to give me a
hug. Nursing assistants.
Yes.
These are what you commonly see at nursing facilities.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Know them well. You know, I know them very well. And we always greet with a hug. And I said, well, wait a minute. You know, we have to practice distancing here. And they went, oh, yeah. And I got the impression that it had not been made adamantly clear that this was a very critical moment and a critical situation. And I don't think that they had really been coached on social distancing. They weren't wearing masks, and you know, one of them a little bit later, he had his cell phone and he wanted to show me some pictures, and he started to approach me again. And I said, "Wait a minute," and so I was having to constantly remind them, and I just felt bad that they
and this
had
was,
not.
This was after it was clear to many of us that the outbreaks were particularly severe in these nursing facilities.
That's yes.
Okay. Not
this
right
was this was like April 1st.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners, Sherry, thank you for being with us. Sherry Mortiz is a retired school teacher in the Des Moines area. Her mother, as she's been telling us about, recently died in a nursing home that was locked down on April 4th. We're so glad that Sherry is here to recount that. If you would join our conversation, tell us about your experience. Perhaps you have a loved one in a nursing home at this time. Tell us about your experience. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Stay with us, Sherry. I want to add Cindy to our conversation. Cindy is joining us on the line from the Waterloo area. Cindy is a CNA, a certified nursing assistant. Cindy, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Cindy, we're using just your first name. You're still working at the facilities you're going to talk about. We decided along with you not to name them so we don't endanger your jobs here. For those who don't know what a CNA does in a nursing facility, briefly tell us what your role is there.
Okay. I'm going to correct you a little bit. I am not working at present time, but I do have a significant other and many friends that are still working in facility.
But you have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I see. Okay.
We kind of term everybody under direct care staff, and that involves CNAs, home health aides, community support staff, et cetera. There are numerous titles, but this is all the staff that does the hands-on care.
I see. Okay. So what does, you've just heard the story there, the account of Sherry with her mother. From your perspective, having had experience in this area, what does this problem look like from your perspective as the problem, I assume, in a shortage of resources beforehand, and then how it was made even more problematic by the COVID crisis?
Yes. I've been involved a lot in advocacy and stuff for direct care staff, and we have been warning for quite some time, legislature and so forth, of the coming staff shortage crisis due to the baby boomer generation and so forth coming to the point of retirement and in needing care themselves. So this has greatly increased the population that needs care. It's very difficult now. We had already reached that point where we were having staff shortages in most all homes, mm-hmm. And in the home health area. Because of that, and the pandemic hitting, it's caused a lot of people to become fearful of working.
Have people actually been quitting as well because of that?
Yes, so that's increased the shortage. Mm-hmm. It breaks my heart because I know that the residents are not getting the care that they should and deserve to have.
Of course.
It's minimal care, absolutely what has to be done, which is very unfortunate.
Just trying to get by in these circumstances, and hopefully better times will come. Your experience,
right.
and the others you know in this direct care staff line of work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and the other thing is many of the staff that are providing this care are at high risk themselves, and they're taking the risk to continue caring for the people.
Right. And Cindy, explain that a little bit, because when you take a risk and you're in the healthcare field at this time, you take a risk getting the virus, that impacts anybody you live with at home, right?
That's right. Yes, it's fearful for family. And I know up in this area now with all that's happened recently, a lot of places are providing motel rooms and camping areas so that staff, if they feel that they can't go home, they can go there. But that's hard because you're isolating from your family as well. And it puts an impact on everyone. It's not just physical health concerns, it's mental health concerns as well. Yeah.
Sure, of course. A lot of mental stress at this time. Before we go to a caller or two, Cindy, tell us, what is your view on how Iowa is handling this pandemic, the increased regulations, the lockdown of the nursing facilities?
I think they need to continue the lockdown. I don't think we're past the crisis, and I'm fearful that we're going to get back to supposed normal a little too soon, and it's going to backfire on us. I hope not, but
yep. Okay,
Cindy, it's just a big fear. This has probably been the worst week for me. Every week gets a little worse. And
what made it so bad this week in particular, Cindy?
You hear things that aren't necessarily on the news yet, I can't relate a lot of that. But the meatpacking plant and the staff that work in nursing homes, a lot of them are family members, and that has just increased the number of cases that have come up.
Yeah, Cindy. Please stay with
one of my friends. Yeah. So,
I'm so sorry to hear that. Cindy calling us from Waterloo. Stay with us, Cindy. We want to check in one of our listeners, 1-866-780-9100. We're looking for people who are having nursing home experiences now, whether you're a loved one trying to visit someone or work in one. Bruce is with us calling from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Bruce. We're coming up on a break. Sure glad you could join us today. What is your angle on this?
Well, the main thing I wanted to get across is my mom's in a facility in Lincoln, Nebraska, and she's 89. But I think what I'm, most of what I'm hearing, relating to, like I think it was Shirley that called a little while ago.
Sherry.
And her mother passed on April 1st.
Yes.
I mean, they have waited too long to, I mean, the people that are in there, in these facilities, they don't have it. I mean, they're getting it from people that are bringing it in, and they cut off family members from seeing them for quite some time now. So I don't think they're doing a good enough job of checking all and testing all the employees that are coming in. I understand there's a lot of turnover, but they have to test these people, and they have to make sure that they don't have it. And they, I mean, so testing is key, especially for employees of these long-term care facilities. And people, you know, it's their, you know, this is their last hurrah before they go. And unfortunately, I just don't feel they're doing a good enough job of, you know, screening the employees, because, I mean, that's the only way that it could be being brought in the last, you know, 6 weeks.
Okay, Bruce, I want to get Cindy's opinion on what you just said before we go to break. Cindy, do you think that's a factor, lack of testing, lack of protective gear in these facilities? Even though they're locked down, there is still a lot of coming and going that can bring the virus in?
Yes. Yes, I've heard reports of using the same masks for too long a period of time. Just a lot of things, that they didn't get enough, what do we want to say, education of what they needed to do, how to deal with it, when they, you know, they didn't, I don't think they started checking soon enough.
Right.
I'm sorry, but that's my opinion.
Bruce in Cedar Rapids, before we go to break and say goodbye to you, how is your mother doing there in assisted living in Nebraska?
Well, 46% of the people that are passing are over the age of 61. The other 51% are under that age, or 54% are under that age. So it's just not old people that are dying in nursing home facilities that people are, you know, so they're kind of poo-pooing it in a lot of ways. I think that's unfortunate. There's a lot of people out there that have it that are not of that age, and they're transmitting it to people. So, there's it's not an easy fix, clearly, but there has to be more testing, and there has to be more vigilance on employees that work in these places, and people in general just need to stay away from each other at least for another couple of weeks, maybe a month.
Bruce, thank you for your view from Cedar Rapids. We appreciate it. All the best to you and to your mother in assisted living in Lincoln, Nebraska. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Sherry Mortiz will stay with us, as will Cindy. We'll be joined in our second half hour by Dr. Glenn Hurst. He's a rural primary care physician in Minden, Iowa, in the western part of the state. He's the medical director at 4 nursing homes in Pottawatomie County. We'll get his view on what's been said and where we go from here. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio, talking about COVID in our nursing facilities. Back in just a moment. So glad you're on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Financial assistance during this crisis has been elusive for many small businesses across the country. Tomorrow on the program, as part of our News Buzz edition of River to River, I'll talk about that problem with Jane Armstrong, Iowa District Director for the U.S. Small Business Administration. Also, we'll hear from an Iowa bookstore owner about why he's delivering books himself during this pandemic. This hour, we're talking about the problem in nursing facilities during this COVID crisis. Roughly one-fifth of U.S. virus deaths are linked to nursing facilities. That figure from a survey by the New York Times. We're talking about why the virus thrives in these facilities, what might be done better, and how many nursing home residents are missing the extra care usually provided by someone in their family. You can share your experience this hour with nursing facilities, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Still with us from the first half hour, Sherry Mortiz, a retired school teacher living in the Des Moines area. Her mother recently died on April 4th in a nursing home that was locked down. Also, Cindy joining us. She's worked as a direct care a staff member in the Waterloo area, telling us about that perspective. In just a moment, we'll be joined by a primary care physician from Western Iowa. But first, let me read an email from one of our listeners, Mary, from the Des Moines area. She says, thanks, Sherry, Sherry Mortiz's personal story. The situation, she writes, with nurse aides and other direct care workers has been dismal for decades. They aren't paid enough, given their responsibilities, and are inadequately trained and supervised. The result, massive turnover and often poor care. COVID only exacerbates the situation. There's been very little leadership at the state level, governor or legislature. We shouldn't have to put up with this. That email from Mary in Des Moines. Let's go to our caller. Elaine is with us. Elaine joining us from the Waterloo area. Hi, Elaine, welcome to our program. What's your perspective? Thank you for joining us. What is your perspective?
Thank you. I have a different perspective because I need home care workers, not nursing home. Mm-hmm. I am a patient, a home care patient mm-hmm. with disabilities. And I have noticed that there's always been a problem, you know, finding caregivers, as your email person just mentioned, Larry. But lately it's been a little harder, not just because caregivers have been either sick or need to stay home with their families, but I've also run across people, caregivers that have been offered higher paying jobs to go to facilities to work. Mm. And that's been tough. So it's very hard to get our cares met at this point right now.
Okay, so you have a smaller pool of caregivers you can turn to reach out to possibly come to your home and help out.
Yes.
Okay.
Elaine,
I'm going to move on now. We've got another guest here, but thank you for your perspective from Waterloo. Let's also talk this hour with Dr. Glenn Hurst. He is a rural primary care physician in Minden, Iowa. That's in the western part of the state. Medical director for 4 nursing homes in Pottawatomie County. This is the county that includes Council Bluffs. Also a rural and senior health policy advocate for our state. Dr. Hurst, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
And I understand you're still working at these facilities, so we decided not to name them because you're not engaged to speak on behalf of them. We just want to make that clear up front. You wrote recently a blog post for the community blog Bleeding Heartland titled COVID-19 Crisis Unmasks Healthcare Systems Failures. Explain the points you wanted to get out in that blog post you wrote.
Sure. I've heard, each of your guests echo the sentiment that I hear from family members and that we hear across the state all the time about the problems that they've noticed because of the COVID crisis. But I'd want to emphasize and reassure those folks that these are problems that we're well aware of. They've been around for a long, long time. And our problem is the lack of resources being put towards nursing homes, not just in this crisis, but for decades back. Mm-hmm. We've seen nursing homes underpaid for the amount of care that they give. We see the expectations of nursing homes held to be the same expectation of a hospital, and that's just not the reality of nursing homes. And we see those patients that are mostly paid by Medicaid, that's 50% of the nursing home population, they underpay per patient about $20 per day. That racks up to a big loss that every facility takes. So it's a crisis that's been going on a long time, and COVID just unmasked it.
Right, and it's become even worse now. So are you saying that in the past, there's just it's even though it's been a bad situation, now that has turned worse, there has been, no political will specifically to change the circumstances?
Correctly. We have exactly what we paid for in terms of the care and the dedication that we give to our seniors. We have not put people in office that feel that this is an important population that deserves good quality care. and dignity in the end of their life, and they underpay for it in very obvious ways.
Mm-hmm. You, as I mentioned, are medical director at four nursing homes in Pottawatomie County. Are you seeing that nursing facilities, long-term care facilities, have a lower priority level than hospitals during this crisis in terms of testing, perhaps in terms of protective gear?
In terms of all levels of care, yes. What we saw back in March, I started looking at the data and saw, based on what was going on around the rest of the world, that there was a potential for thousands of people needing hospitalization just in our region alone. And that's moving on from hospital to nursing home level. How many beds were we going to need? And I calculated that out, that we'd need 160 nursing home beds to address the wave of people coming through the facility if we didn't have a different trajectory, which thank God we have had a different trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
But what we saw was all the attention went to the bottleneck at the ICU beds. We had 10 ICU beds in the Council Bluffs area that we could fill. And once those were filled, how do we empty those beds? Nobody looked at that issue. Their plan was just to move those patients to the nursing home without thinking ahead that we have a limited number of nursing home beds, so we need to address that issue. And without thinking ahead to, for every one patient we move from the hospital to the nursing home, we're going to send 10 patients from the nursing home back to the hospital because of the way this disease spreads. So there was no thought on that.
So just to be clear, once you let it in the door in the form of somebody maybe transferred from an ICU who is COVID-19 positive, because of the nature of our nursing facilities, close quarters and staff moving between rooms from patient to patient, it's just a fertile field for this virus to spread like wildfire.
Correct. If you watch the numbers from the Iowa Department of Public Health, we see a facility show up on the list of outbreak with 6 patients, and 2 days later, they have 30. So that number just shows this spreads and spreads. I've made personal phone calls to the state epidemiologists, and those epidemiologists cannot tell me of any facility that has had a positive case that remains below the outbreak status for any period of time. If it gets into your facility, it will spread like wildfire.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So one of the things we're...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things we're trying to do here in Western Iowa is to get reassurance from our local hospitals that they're not going to send us positive patients, though they demanded that initially. We had to put our foot down and say, we're not going to take those. And we're still not getting reassurance from the regional management care coordinators that they won't try to make us keep our positive patients if we have something happen like a staff member brings it in and somebody gets infected. Our desire would be to move that patient out of the facility immediately to prevent the spread, test everybody in the facility, but of course we don't have testing for that. So we're in a real spot to prevent this from coming in.
Dr. Glenn Hurst.
Fighting within the system.
If you just joined us, Dr. Glenn Hurst is with us, a rural primary care physician in Western Iowa, medical director for 4 nursing homes in Pottawatomie County. Now, I'm just imagining so many listeners with family members in these care facilities hearing what you just said. Can family members go to the facility and get the status? Like, are you accepting, would you accept any COVID-19 positive patients from ICUs or other areas to find out what that policy is? Is that a good idea? What do you recommend for loved ones?
It's a great idea that they should be contacting the facilities and telling them that they do not want their family member exposed to a case that comes in, a known case from the hospital. Mm-hmm. That would be the first step that they can take to protect their loved one. They can also contact their local emergency management agency. And if they can find a way to contact the RMCC, because that hasn't happened for me yet, they should let them know that as well.
Mm-hmm. And that contact would perhaps empower the administrators of that particular facility, would it not? Because they could say, listen, I have half the people of the loved ones of half the people here saying, do not do this.
Correct. And part of the problem for the facility is they've been given a survey that they fill out every morning that says whether or not they will accept new patients. Doesn't say whether they'll accept new COVID patients or not, just new patients in general. And that then they go on to a list of places that may get a transfer from a hospital to their facility. If they're not prepared to accept those transfers, they can make that kind of statement so that that they're not on the list to receive any patients. But these places do still need to be seeing patients and need to be keeping their beds filled. They're already operating at, you know, thousands of dollars a year under the reimbursement necessary to take care of these patients. So right. They've got a financial problem as well.
For the four facilities that you serve as a medical director, Dr. Hurst, do you have any COVID positive patients? What is the status of the direct care that you've been, direct observation, supervision that you've been giving to these facilities? What can you tell us?
Sure. Yes, we have no positive cases in any facilities that I'm the medical director for in Pottawatomie County. I have to praise the staff that are performing this Herculean effort to prevent the condition from coming in. They're, you know, conserving PPE, but using it appropriately as much as possible. They are screening every person who comes in and out that door. They've got isolation units set up for patients who are coming in from the hospital with an unknown history, maybe not COVID symptoms at all, but just anybody that comes in gets isolated in the space for 14 days for observation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dedicating staff to that duty. And plus the four of us, the four facilities have been working together actually in an attempt to open another facility where they would be able to transfer their COVID patients to immediately. They've really bound together for the interest of their patients and the lives of the people we've been taking care of for decades to prevent this from getting in.
Okay, Dr. Glenn Hurst with us for a few more minutes, primary care physician in Western Iowa. Let's go back to our phones. Danielle is joining us from Woodward, Iowa. Danielle, welcome to the program. I understand you have certain expertise in this area.
No, I don't. I just have a parent that I watch die and one that we're keeping out of facilities. I have science as my wheelhouse, not medical science.
I see.
But when my father went to the hospital for something fairly simple and ended up in intensive care, and then they, one side of the next room over had a sign on the door that C. diff was there. Then the opposite door had a C. diff warning. Mm-hmm. And then my father got C. diff. And I was watching the patterns in the hospital because I went out to help him and my family. And the pattern that I see, a vector, is the screen. It's that cloth screen. The doctors glove up. They touch the screen. They move the privacy screen back and forth. Then another healthcare person comes in with their hand gloved. They have not taken off the glove. They've come in from the ward where they've been treating other patients with C. diff. And I think that's how it moves around these facilities. I understand COVID is airborne, but I'd like to know if anyone has looked at that kind of pattern and addressed this privacy curtain as part of the vector issue.
Mm-hmm. Let's, Dr. Hurst, what do you think of that observation by Danielle?
Sure. You know, we have to look at the entire picture when we look at a patient. And that's an excellent observation that when we're talking about what happens with this particular patient, we also need to look at how does that affect all the patients around them. Now, I can't talk to you specifically about tests that have been done on screens for C. diff, but there are absolutely policies and procedures that go into place that look at research on where do we see these vectors occurring. So I can't speak to that one in particular, but I can certainly speak to the COVID-19 vector of a patient who comes to a nursing home facility and we're not able to keep that nursing home facility COVID negative. We've got to think about what's happening to the rest of the patients in that population when we bring that patient in for care. We could certainly care for that patient and help them heal, but at what cost?
Mm-hmm. Danielle, anything to add before we say goodbye? Thank you for your input.
I would just like people who have their parents or family members in the facilities, watch for the patterns. Watch who's touching those curtains and see if you don't see a pattern.
Danielle, thank you for calling from Woodward. I want to ask you, Doctor, before we say goodbye in a few minutes here, what are your thoughts, perhaps your concerns, with the move across the country, also in the state, to loosen the current practices, to try to get back to something more like normal in our society?
Well, I think it's premature. You know, when we have talked about all this effort in social distancing and PPE and wearing masks up to this point, the idea was to lower that peak of cases so that we didn't overwhelm our resources. And it appears that we have done that. We have indeed lowered the peak. But peak is being misinterpreted, I think. We now will not have a sharp peak. We're going to have a long plateau. And it's important that we continue what we've been doing to keep that plateau nice and level so that we don't overwhelm our resources. Time will pass, and this will get better, and we will be able to engage as we used to. But I think it would be unwise to follow the governor's current direction.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hurst, given the pre-existing shortages of resources, the stretched resources at nursing homes, nursing facilities in the ones that you direct and other ones across the country, do you think this is likely to be a wake-up call? It seems like perhaps for our entire healthcare system, it is a wake-up call that I guess we don't know whether that call will be answered, do we? What is your hope for the future and that this health crisis may have in months or years as a silver lining?
Sure. Well, you know, quoting my friend John Hale from the Hale Group, which is a group that does long-term care advocacy. Our hope is that in unmasking this problem, that we can begin to motivate legislators and bureaucracy to reevaluate how we value our seniors and how we value our own livelihood when we reach that the age of needing some additional care.
Right. Dr. Hurst, what is at the top of your priority list, your to-do list today, tomorrow, the rest of in next week?
So the top of my list is to keep my patients safe. And in doing that, that means good preventative care from my staff and families coming in and out of the facility, and to prevent hospitals from sending those patients to our facilities. I'd like to see our state engage our critical access hospital network as the step-down units for those facilities so that they can use their skilled beds, their swing beds, which are a hospital/nursing home-style bed, but also employ their hospital expertise on infection control.
Mm-hmm. How, in a few seconds, as a doctor, observing this, working in this atmosphere, how long do you expect this crisis to last?
I'm not expecting to relax much until August in terms of our nursing facilities. It is still a great unknown as to what the summer will mean to this virus. We see this virus in Taiwan. We see this virus in Thailand and South Korea, places with more tropical temperatures. I don't know why we believe that the weather is necessarily going to be the answer. I think there's still every reason to be overly cautious rather than relaxing.
Dr. Glenn Hurst, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
Cindy, if you're still there from the Waterloo area, thank you for sharing your experience as a direct care staff in nursing facilities. We appreciate your perspective. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
And Sherry Mortiz, thank you. Retired school teacher living in Des Moines. Mother recently died in a nursing home that was locked down. We wish you all the best. Again, deeply sorry for the loss of your mother and those circumstances when she died under these lockdown conditions. Sherry Mortiz, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on the program, financial assistance. We've been hearing this in the news as during this crisis. It's been elusive for many small businesses across the country. Tomorrow in our News Buzz edition, we'll talk about that problem with Jane Armstrong. She's with the U.S. Small Business Administration. That's tomorrow. Plenty more on our News Buzz edition. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow.